The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jim Cronin from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from the Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. And let's talk about cholesterol, the health section of the Reader's Digest. The new truth about cholesterol. The latest research and information will help you keep your levels in check. For most of my adult life, I mostly avoided eggs. I had read that since yolks are full of cholesterol, eating them would raise my blood cholesterol and harm my heart health. Then, about 3 years ago, with the goal of losing a few pounds, I reduced simple carbs and added more protein, including eggs, to my diet. I wondered what that would do to my cholesterol levels, so at my next checkup, I asked for a blood test. My doctor surprised me with this response. We were wrong about that all along. The best research says you don't need to avoid eggs. To reassure me, she ordered the blood test. The results? Same healthy cholesterol levels as before. It got me wondering how many other people were unnecessarily avoiding eggs and other foods based on old information. And now that I was in my 50s, what else should I be doing to make sure my cholesterol stayed in the safe zone? My research turned up some surprising facts. First, the basics. High cholesterol is a major risk factor for cardiovascular disease. According to the largest ever study of cholesterol levels, led by Imperial College London and published in 2020, high cholesterol is responsible for about 3.9 million deaths annually worldwide. Cholesterol is a waxy substance produced by the liver and found in every cell in the body. It helps the body build hormones, vitamin D, and healthy cells, digest fatty foods, and more. There are two main lipoproteins that carry cholesterol in the blood. Low-density lipoprotein, LDL, the main type of bad cholesterol, delivers fatty particles throughout the body. The buildup of LDL on an artery wall can block blood flow and lead to blood clots. This can cause a heart attack or a stroke. High-density lipoprotein, HDL, is considered good cholesterol because it picks up the LDL particles and returns them to the liver for excretion. I also discovered some myths floating around about the causes and treatments of high cholesterol. It's time to set the record straight. Myth. Foods that contain cholesterol unhealthy. Truth. Some are, but not all. When a blood test shows a high level of LDL or other bad cholesterol, referred to as non-HDL cholesterol, it's likely due to eating the wrong foods. But just because a food contains cholesterol doesn't mean eating it will raise yours. Research in the 1960s linked the two, but several studies in the decades since have put this mistaken belief to rest. It depends more on the food's saturated fat content. Cholesterol is found in animal products, meat, seafood, egg yolks, and dairy products, and those high in saturated fat raise blood cholesterol. The cholesterol and saturated fats reinforce each other when eaten simultaneously, making the effect on the body even worse, said Martin Kajetjen, professor emeritus of nutrition at Free University Amsterdam. The worst culprits are high-fat dairy products, fatty red meats, and processed meats, whereas seafoods such as prawns and squid, while high in cholesterol, are lower in saturated fat. The best way to reduce LDL is to replace saturated fats with unsaturated fats. For example, says Catan, switching from butter to soft margarine and cooking with vegetable oils such as sunflower, corn, canola, or olive. These contain linoleic acids, which can actually lower your LDL cholesterol. As for dairy, Catan says, go low-fat and consider cheese a treat. He adds that optimal foods for keeping cholesterol in check include legumes and beans, whole grains such as oatmeal and vegetables. For eggs, recommendations vary for how many are safe to consume. The American Heart Association says that healthy adults can safely eat one per day and warned that it's what often accompanies eggs, bacon, and sausage, which are heavy in saturated fat, that lead to high dietary cholesterol. Avocados, for example, are rich in healthy monounsaturated fatty acids. Avocado helps lower your LDLs of LDL, bad cholesterol. The American Heart Association approves of one a day. Bacon. These crispy cholesterol bombs are high in unhealthy saturated fat and should be treated as an occasional indulgence, not a daily staple. As I say that as I ate three pieces of bacon this morning with my breakfast. Myth. If my cholesterol is high, I'll feel it. Truth. Only a test can tell you. 5 years ago, Frederick Sundell was active and at a healthy weight, but a company health checkup showed his cholesterol levels were borderline high. I was surprised, because I felt fine, says the now 49-year-old CFO of a publishing company in Helsinki. I thought if I had a heart health problem, I'd know it. Maybe I'd have faster heartbeat or be short of breath. The doctor told Sandell he should try to make lifestyle improvements to try to keep it in check. Otherwise, he'd have to go on medication. So he made an effort to incorporate more fitness into his day by walking instead of driving and by doing more cross-country skiing in the winter. He also took more care to eat healthily, although he admits I wasn't always an angel. While exercise won't lower LDL cholesterol, diet is the biggest factor there. It can increase HDL, says Professor Ian Graham, head of cardiovascular medicine at Trinity College in Dublin. The only way to know if you have high cholesterol is to get a test. Some experts believe that testing should start when people are in their 30s or even in their 20s. Testing cholesterol levels in young people could be life-saving, says Fabian Brunner, a cardiologist at the University Medical Center Hamburg at Eppendorf. In the United States, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recommends that adults 21 and older with no risk factors get their cholesterol checked every 4 to 6 years, and that kids get theirs checked between 9 and 11. Dr. Brunner was the lead author of an international study published in 2019 that analyzed decades of population-based data control on cardiovascular patients. The research has estimated the long-term risk of a cardiovascular event by the time someone was 75 and calculated the potential benefit of lowering non-HDL cholesterol earlier in life. Their results showed that doing so helps reduce the risk of cardiovascular disease. To calculate a risk, go to nonhdlrisk.com. That's nonhdlrisk.com. Myth. Statins often have bad side effects. Truth. The side effects are rare. When Ricardo Saints, 51-year-old engineer in Madrid, had a checkup around 4 years ago, his cholesterol levels were within the healthy range. But because he had high blood pressure, a major risk for heart attacks and stroke, his doctor said he'd have to reduce his cholesterol and recommended he begin taking a statin drug. Statins lower the production of LDL cholesterol by blocking an enzyme in the liver that helps make it. They stabilize the plaque in your arteries to keep it from breaking off and causing a heart attack or a stroke, says Christopher Allen, head of healthcare at Heart UK, the cholesterol charity. They're a proven, incredibly effective drug. Statins reduce the chance of cardiac events by 30%. When Saints got home with the prescription, his wife told him she had heard that statin drugs had side effects. That did make me hesitate, but I went ahead with my doctor's orders, he says. It's been 4 years and I have had no side effects at all. Statins, which have widely used and have been around since the 1980s, have fallen victim to the age of misinformation, according to a paper published in 2019 by the European Society of Cardiology, ESC. There are rumors they cause type 2 diabetes, cancer, and even dementia. In reality, while the most common effect reported by statin users is muscle aches, according to the ESC, they occur in less than 1% of patients and are often alleviated by switching to another brand of statin. As for claims that statins cause cancer, a 2020 study by Johns Hopkins Medicine shows statins may actually starve cancer cells. What about statins and dementia? A 2016 study looked at 400,000 Americans who regularly used statins for at least 2 years and found that over a span of 4 years, the men had a 12% lower risk of getting Alzheimer's disease and women a 15% lower risk. There is no hard evidence of cognitive impairment, says Graham, and indeed the risk of vascular dementia is probably reduced. That's the second most form of dementia after Alzheimer's disease. For people who can't take statins, new injectable medications called PCSK9 inhibitors work by blocking production of a protein in the liver so that the liver can better remove cholesterol from the blood. Myth, I can prevent high cholesterol with an exercise and diet. Truth, if it's genetic, you can't avoid it. Renee Wheeling, 59, a former model from Toronto, never worried about her heart health. She worked out like an Olympic athlete regularly, doing aerobics and weight training, and maintained a super healthy diet. Then when she was 54, she had her first cholesterol test and was shocked to discover it was dangerously high. It turns out she has a familial hypercholesterolemia, FH, which means her body was unable to rid her blood of LDL cholesterol. FH has no symptoms and it occurs in around 1 in 250 people. It's genetic, Graham explains. If the condition is inherited from one or worse, both parents, untreated high cholesterol will often result in a heart attack when you're relatively young. But you won't know you have FH without a test. In almost all cases, people with FH can't lower their cholesterol to a healthy level without medication. Welling's doctor put her on statins, and they worked. Her cholesterol levels are now well within the healthy zone. Thank goodness I was tested, she says. How about some humor in uniform? Marching in basic training, an Air Force cadet was constantly getting reamed out for watching the planes flying overhead instead of keeping his eyes forward. Finally, instructors had enough and devised an appropriate punishment. For the rest of that day, the cadet had to stand on the edge of the training area and wave to every plane that flew past, shouting, "Bye-bye! Have a nice flight!" My 6-year-old son and I were watching soldiers parading through our small town. Among the marchers were police officers, military police officers, wearing armbands with the letter MP emblazoned on them. I asked Michael, "Do you know what those letters stand for?" "Yes," he said, "important." How about some animal opposites? You've heard of porcupines. How about a rich coupon? Armadillos? How about a legadillo? Kangaroos? How about a cantgaroo? How about an alligator becoming a nonagator? A gorilla being a stop gorilla. And I guess that's it. The others are not very. Oh, an anteater being an uncle eater. That's pretty funny. Run over by a speedboat. A gruesome accident nearly cured Carter Viss. Healing from his injuries would be tough. Forgiving the boat's driver even tougher. This is a drama in real life. And it shows a young man standing on the beach with a hotel in the background, and he has lost his right arm. Beneath an ocean surface waits a different world, quiet, full of wonder, shimmering with life. Carter Viss loved that world. It's why he left Colorado to study marine biology at Palm Beach Atlantic University. It's why he got a job at Loggerhead Marine Life Center just up Highway 1 on Florida's East Coast. And that's why he spent so much free time snorkeling in the reef system just a few hundred yards from the famous Breakers Resort in Palm Beach. This particular Thursday morning, November 28, 2019, was especially nice. It was Thanksgiving. Tourists and locals hit the beaches. The water was flat, the sky blue, and the underwater visibility spectacular. Carter, 25, and his co-worker, Andy Earle, 32, spent a couple of hours among the sharks, eels, turtles, octopuses, lionfish, and angelfish. They netted some small specimens for Carter's personal collection. Finally, around noon, they began their journey back to shore. To a diver underwater, outboard engines have a clear, unmistakable sound. Swimming on the surface, however, Carter didn't hear the speedboat. It was just 50 feet away and heading straight for him. The Tally Girl was a white 36-footer with an aqua-colored hull, but the boat's most striking feature was a trio of massive 400-horsepower Mercury outboard engines with 5-blade propellers. Gosh, that's a lot of power. All that power had it gliding over the water at 50 miles per hour, much too fast with swimmers nearby. Christine Reininger was sitting atop her paddleboard, waving her hand, yelling, "Hey, slow down!" But the people on the boat, a retired Goldman Sachs executive, Daniel Stanton Sr., his 30-year-old son, Daniel Jr., and his son-in-law and 2 grandchildren, never heard her warnings over the roar of those engines. The Tally Girl was almost on top of Carter by the time he saw it. He pulled desperately to one side, getting his head and upper torso out of the board's path before it ran him over, sending him tumbling and somersaulting. The propeller of the far-right engine had sliced his right forearm clean off, turning the water around him crimson. "This can't be happened," Carter thought. It was too bizarre. Inhaling seawater in his own blood, Carter realized he would drown if he didn't swim. But he couldn't swim. His right arm was gone. Both his legs were smashed, dangling useless beneath him, and his remaining hand was damaged. Bobbing for a second, he screamed for his life before slipping beneath the surface. Andy Hurl heard his friend's cries. He swam toward Carter, reaching him at about the same time as Reininger, who had watched the horror unfold. While Earl kept Carter's face out of the water, Reininger squeezed his upper arm to stem the blood flow, then fashioning a tourniquet from the cord on her paddleboard. Meanwhile, on the Tally Girl, a frantic Stanton Jr. threw the engine into reverse, stopping alongside the stricken swimmer. Horrified, in shock, he helped Earl and Reininger load Carter onto the dive platform at the boat's stern. "I'm not going to make it," Carter thought, pain searing through his adrenaline. "No way I'm going to make it." "God is with us," Earl reassured his friend over and over, holding his hand as Tally Girl made for shore. Carter is a devout Christian, felt his fear and panic melt away. In his place came total surrender, a kind of blissful acceptance. Dying felt as if he were diving again, this time into another beautifully peaceful rain. As it turned out, the worst day of Carter's life was not without things to be thankful for. Earl and Reininger being nearby, for one, the speedboat reversing so quickly, the first responders who waded into the ocean to meet Tally Girl, the ambulance that raced to St. Mary's Medical Center, The 12-person critical care team, already briefed and suited up, that received Carter in the trauma bay barely 20 minutes after the boat strike. Also fortunate was the fact that Robert Borrego, a critical surgeon and a medical director of trauma at St. Mary's, was on duty. The son of a Cuban fisherman, Dr. Borrego, had come to America at age 9. 30 years at St. Mary's and a stint at a field hospital in Iraq had acclimated him to dealing with massive trauma. Many soldiers had been devastated by improvised explosive devices, commonly known as IEDs. Carter's injuries were not so different, with one exception. Major open wounds in the ocean are doubly perilous, as the victims keep bleeding because blood can't clot, and infection is very likely. The doctor did a quick assessment. Carter was in stage 4 shock, meaning he lost at least 40% of his blood volume and was on the verge of multi-organ failure. A diver had retrieved Carter's arm, but there was no hope of reattaching it. Next, Dr. Borrego noted the damage to Carter's left hand and wrist. His right knee was dislocated and deeply lacerated, his kneecap nearly severed, and his femur fractured. His lower left leg and ankle were smashed, with deep gashes in the flesh, and his left foot was turning blue. It was a miracle Carter had gotten to the hospital alive, but every moment counted. One option was to amputate both legs. Amputation could be done quickly and would lower the risk of infection. But one doctor, Dylan, and this is an interesting spelling, A-B-E-Y-E-W-A-R-D-N-E, Abiwardine, pointed out that Carter was young and active, with his entire life ahead of him. Surely it was worth trying to save his legs. Dr. Borrego agreed. A team of 3 surgeons and 2 residents set to work. And there's a picture of him lying in bed, bandaged up, with his mother, Leela. One or both of his parents remained by his side throughout the hospital stay. A team of 3 surgeons and 2 residents set to work. First, they trimmed the loose skin around the mangled stump of Carter's upper arm. This procedure, called guillotine amputation, makes for a cleaner cut, allowing for easier cleaning of the wound before it's closed. Next, doctors reset both legs, encasing each in a fixator, a sort of exoskeleton that maintains proper alignment as the bones begin their slow repair process. They also set the fractures in Carter's left hand and wrist and repaired the soft tissue damage. After an intense 3.5 hours in the operating room, liberally infused with 8 units each of red blood cells, plasma, and platelets, Carter was moved to the ICU. For the next 48 to 72 hours, it would be critical. The human body can fight only so many battles at once before shutting down. All anyone could do now was to wait and hope and pray. In Centennial, a city outside of Denver, Chuck and Lena Viss were taking a chilly, snowy walk after church when Lena's cell phone rang. The display showed a floater number. She assumed it was a telemarketing robocall. Back in the car, heading home to start dinner, she saw there were 2 voicemail messages. She put the phone on speaker so Chuck could listen as well. It was the sheriff in Palm Beach County. As a mother of 3 active boys, Carter is her middle son. Leela wondered, what's Carter done? As they recall hearing, boating accident, lost one arm, trying to save his legs. Panic, they pulled into a parking lot. We took turns losing it and comforting each other, says Leela. The day became desperate. Her blurry scrambled of canceled dinner plans, urgent calls, postponed work deadlines, and attempts to book flights on a holiday. Chuck finally found 2 seats on a plane out of Denver that evening, with a layover in Boston. Frayed and exhausted, Leela and Chuck reached St. Mary's intensive care unit around 10 a.m. The atmosphere was calm but intense, as doctors and nurses moved with purposeful efficiency. But any sense of calm for the couple disintegrated when they saw their son. The sight of Carter in bed, with swollen, bandaged right forearm missing, fixators on his legs and tubes down his throat, was overwhelming. Leela and Chuck had to be helped out of the room to compose themselves. They began their vigil. The pair took turns by their son's bedside, where Carter was hooked up to a ventilator. He was tormented by hallucinations, ICU psychosis, doctor call it, which could be caused by medicine, infection, even low blood oxygen. He knew his family was there, but so were strange, gruesome creatures that were crawling all over him. Get them off of me, he begged. Carter was so out of it that he didn't know he'd already had 4 operations. Infected flesh had been excised, a titanium rod inserted in his shattered shin bone, and hardware installed in his left wrist and right knee. Nor did he recall the many visits he'd had from church friends and loggerhead colleagues. One or more or both of his parents was always by his side. Chuck, an employee of the software company Oracle, was able to work remotely. Leela, a church organist and piano teacher, needed to be back in Centennial. So Chuck took up residence in a nearby condo, and Leela commuted. Over the 68 days Carter spent in the hospital, Chuck and Lita noted each milestone. The first day he sat up, being moved out of ICU to a step-down room, the first time he wiggled his toes, the first time he sat in a wheelchair, the first day he ate actual food, hospital jello and chicken broth Chuck brought him, the day Carter stood unaided, and a few days after that, his first shaky, excruciatingly painful steps. Arguably, the most significant milestone came the day Carter had his breathing tube removed. That's when Dr. Borrego told him the battle was 90% won. Carter says in that moment he knew two things. I've got a long road ahead of me, and I'm going to make it. He decided then that he would put his spare life to good use by educating others about ocean safety and conservation. Heading into yet another surgery, he told his parents, I can make a bigger difference now than I ever could before. But before he could do that, he had one last battle to fight. Getting off the heavy doses of morphine, oxycodone, and fentanyl that had eased his pain, Dr. Borrego gradually reduced his dosage until his patients, determined to use nothing more than Advil and medical marijuana, tore off his fentanyl patch. Withdrawal made for a harrowing few days, but Carter, as Dr. Borrego puts it, has incredible mental strength, just extraordinary. Carter was discharged from St. Mary's in February of 2020. By June, 7 months after the accident, he returned to work at the Marine Life Center. Fittingly, his duties included helping with the rehabilitation of loggerhead sea turtles that had been injured in boat strikes. Today, he has bent his right knee only 90 degrees. For a while, residual infections had him on and off by antibiotics. He's been perfitted with a prosthetic forearm, but finds it cumbersome. Still, Dr. Borrego says that his recovery has been almost miraculous. Physical healing is one thing. The emotional legacy is less obvious, more nuanced. The accident itself, Carter says, I try not to remember how real it was, the panic and horror. It feels more like remembering a dream now or a nightmare. I try not to think of what I can't do. I focus on ways to work around things. As Carter got on with his life, Daniel Stanton Jr. was going through his own agony. Consumed with guilt, he told the Palm Beach Post that he kept reliving the scene of the accident over and over in his mind. Not a day has passed since Thanksgiving where I haven't thought about the terrible events of that day and all that Carter has been through since, he says. I imagine it will weigh on me every day for the rest of my life. Last September, Stanton was charged with willful and reckless operation of a vessel, a first-degree misdemeanor punished by up to a year in jail. The prosecutor gave us several options, says Chuck. Carter insisted he did not want Stanton to face incarceration. He said, I'd rather have him working with me on ocean safety than sitting in a jail cell. 2 months later, almost a year after the day of the accident, Carter Viss and Daniel Stanton Jr. entered the courtroom. The sight of Stanton caused Carter to flash back to the accident. It was jarring, but thankfully brief. A few minutes later, Carter read a victim statement. Imagine yourself doing the thing you love, he said, recalling the day of the accident. Then in a matter of seconds, your joy and contentment is interrupted by a sudden impact. After describing the horror he had endured, Carter said, This is not a story from a war zone, but from an area you once called your happy place. And yet he somehow found the silver lining in his trauma. I believe that everything happens for a reason, and all the pieces are in place to make positive changes for marine safety, he said. Then it was Stanton's turn to speak. Addressing Carter directly, he said, I cannot fathom the physical and emotional pain you and your family have endured. The visitor knew the remorse was genuine. You could see the pain in his eyes, Chuck said. Heeding Carter's wishes, the judge sentenced to 75 hours of community service, a year's probation, and a $1,000 fine, and a mandate to work with Carter on legislation to enhance ocean safety and conservation. After the judge handed down his ruling, Carter shook Stanton's hand and said quietly, Let's make a difference. And they are. For starters, the two are advocating for clearer diver-down markers off beaches and strict speed limit for boats. Has the legal resolution debt of forgiveness? Forgiveness comes from the heart, says Carter. I feel like I'm going in the right direction. If I were him and had to live with the guilt and remorse, I'd almost prefer to be in my shoes. But if I can ease someone else's pain, I will. And there's a picture of Carter back in the lab tending to a lionfish. And then there's another picture of Carter with his four heroes, Dr. Borrego, Dr. Dylan Abrahabawadne, Andy Earle, Kristen Reininger. And Dr. Robert Borrego is a very distinguished, slightly dark-complected, with pure white hair and wearing dark sunglasses. And Dr. Dylan is a very good-looking young man with a beard. And then, of course, there's Carter, and then there's Andy Earl, who's kind of middle-aged, looks like, and has got a bald head. And there's Christine Reininger, who is flexing her biceps. Looks like she's a really athletic young woman. Your True Stories in 100 Words. Abandon hope, all ye who enter. My cell phone rang the other day, but the caller was looking for someone else. When I told her she had the wrong number, she verified that she had dialed correctly, then asked whether a certain email address was mine. It wasn't. She said the person she was looking for had filled in an online job application and was using my number. Perhaps it just typed it wrong, I said. What's the job for, she replied. Data entry. That's terrible. Not for nothing. My grandmother enjoyed gambling. She would play cards with anyone and loved scratch-off lottery tickets. After I received a call on the day she died, I went for a walk. At some point, I came across a lottery stand. I looked to the heavens and asked Grandma to send me a number. 2 and 6 popped into my head. I pleaded, I need a third, but I got nothing. Not knowing what to do, I played 126. The winning number was 026. Who's the boss? I was in 1974. I was an undergraduate at the University of Hartford. I remember a young fellow pulling up to me in his car one day and asking, "Where's the gym?" I figured he had come to see the concert that was happening in the gym that evening, but I remember thinking he was awful early for it. I went to that concert. The fellow who had asked for direction was there all right, on stage. No one knew who he was, but I am so impressed with him. Sometimes later I learned his name, Bruce Springsteen. Trusted brands. Dirt can't hide. How a stealth team of chemists discovered a mix of molecules that changed laundry forever. And there's a picture of a liquid Tide container. For many of us, Tide is the most squeaky clean of home helpers. In 2018, Americans bought $1.7 billion worth of Tide products, more than all other detergents, including Purex, Pazzel, Gain, and Arm & Hammer, combined. This year, 4,000 Americans surveyed by the global marketing research firm Ipsos for the annual Reader's Digest Most Trusted Brands survey selected this super cleaner not only as the most trusted detergent brand, but also as the single most trusted brand in the home and family products category. America's first name in laundry has an interesting backstory, but the origin of the name itself was apparently unrecorded, which is ironic, given the bold name and packaging have played a role in Tide's success. When Cincinnati-based manufacturer Procter & Gamble set out to create Tide in the 1930s, it was referred to as Project X. The code name reflected P&G's recognition that its team was engineering something revolutionary. At the time, washing powders were nothing more than pulverized soap. They weren't great at cleaning the kind of ground-in dirt by the average blue-collar worker, not to mention the average red-letter five-year-old. Plus, soap is made from fats and oils, ingredients that don't dissolve in water and do leave behind a residue, a.k.a. the dreaded soap scum, that stiffens when clothes dry. Procter & Gamble had been in the home product business since the Civil War. The company first sold soap and candles made from animal fats readily available from the nearby meat packers. But as the 20th century took shape, kerosene replaced candles, and plant-based cleaners such as Ivory soap replaced those made from animal fats. Procter & Gamble was seeing a huge chunk of business being washed down the drain. The hope was that the newfangled, entirely synthetic Project X would save it. This may ruin the soap business, P&G's chairman Wimble Gamble said at one point, but if anybody is going to ruin the soap business, it had better be Procter & Gamble. And there's a picture of an early box, and it took a decade for David Byerly and his team of chemists to create the Sudsy breakthrough. And there's a picture of David Byerly, and there's also a picture of an old-time ad with a revolutionary sign on Tide. P&G's top secret man was read by a chemist named David Dick Byerly, who had started working on a synthetic detergent well before World War II. At first, many of his formulas cleaned clothes but left them like sandpaper, says Thomas Halberstadt, one of Byerly's supervisors. The big bosses grew tired of Byerly's failure. The only comments he ever got were, "What in the hell are you working on that for?" Halberstadt said in a 1984 interview. But Dick was an obstinate cuss in some ways, tenacious as all get out. It took Byerly and the Cincinnati chemist 10 years to come up with a solution. They finally hit upon a mixture of alkyl sulfate and sodium triopolyphosphate, a combination that creates molecules that grab hard not only to grease and dirt, but also to water. It all just rinses away, leaving clean fabric without any soapy residue. It was ultimately a triumph of trial and error. As the American Chemical Society put it, no one could figure out why it worked, but it worked. And Tide was an instant success. Sold first as powder, the product hit the market just as America's great post-war worm boom began. New Suburbans' homes with their new appliances, including recently invented top-loading washers, needed something big. P&G's marketing department leaped into action, giving boxes away with washing machines and flooding magazines and newspapers with ads showing happy, healthy housewives literally hugging the iconic orange box. While the original plan was to market Tide in the soap scum-plagued hard water Midwest, the product soon caught on everywhere. By the 1950s, the P&G officials who once dismissed Project X were boasting about one called the first big change in soap making in 2,000 years. Eventually, it would be turned into a liquid, 1984, and then a fantastically profitable Tide Power Pods in 2012, which cost a whopping 67 cents a load, compared with about 28 cents a load for the ordinary liquid variety. Of course, those rainbow-colored pods proved to be one of P&G's biggest challenges since the run-up to Project X. Children thought the pods looked like candy and ate them, leading to thousands of calls to poison control centers across the country. Fortunately, P&G designers sprang into action, adding extra child-proof packages and a bitter taste to discourage kids from swallowing the pods. And P&G has continued to use its labs to find new ways to keep Tide in washing machines and shopping carts. The company has developed an almost endless series of varieties. Tide with special scents or no scent at all, Tide with fabric softeners, and most recently, high-powered Tide for environmental-friendly cold water washes. And soon, perhaps the newest variety might be Space Tide, the product of a new partnership between P&G and NASA. The average space station astronaut goes through about 150 sweat-soaked pounds of clothes a year, much of which ends up getting dumped into the void to burn up while tumbling back to Earth. A Mars mission won't have the luxury of restocking, so next year Tide will take a test run to the International Space Station to see how well the detergent cleans and reacts to low water, no gravity environment outside of Earth's atmosphere. It's another monumental challenge, of course. Then again, P&G has always said that when it comes to Tide's ability to clean, the sky's the limit. We'll soon see, literally, how true that is. 19 other most trusted home and family brands. Here are the rest of the winners from R&D's latest collaboration with global market research firm Ipsos, which asked 4,000 American ages 18 and older to name their single most trusted brand in each of the following categories. Auto insurance was Geico. Passenger cars, excluding trucks, was Toyota. SUV crossover, Toyota. Airline, Southwest. Cruise line, Qualifer Cruise Line. National hotel chain, Marriott. Wireless provider, Verizon. Home furniture retailer, IKEA. Household cleaning products, Lysol. Interior paint, Bayer. Disinfectant wipes, Lysol. Home insurance, State Farm. Retirement investment services, Fidelity. Pet food, Purina. Pet treats, Milk-Bone. Cat litter, Tidy Cats. Pet insurance, Nationwide. Pet retailer, PetSmart. Home security, ADT Security Services. And with that, let's switch over to the big problem with plastic from Consumer Reports. Think that all of what you toss in the recycling bin actually gets recycled? Think again. Consumer Reports reveals where most of the plastic you throw away ends up and explains what you can do to limit its environmental harm. Consider the amount of plastic you put in the trash you're recycling on a typical day. There's a lid to your coffee cup and perhaps a bag from a newspaper. There's a wrapper from a granola bar, a yogurt container, a salad clamshell, and a plentiful packaging from inside a box that arrived in the mail. Many of these plastic items are useful and convenient, but they also come with a high environmental cost. In 2016, the U.S. generated more plastic trash than any other country, 46.3 million tons of it, according to a 2020 study published in Science Advances. That's 287 pounds per person in a single year. By the time all these disposable products are in your hands, they've already taken a toll on the planet. Plastics are mostly made from fossil fuels in an energy-intensive process that ignites greenhouse gases and creates often hazardous chemicals. And then there's what happens when you throw them away. If you're like most people, you probably assume that when you toss plastic into a recycling bin, it will be processed and turned into something new. That truth is not only a fraction of plastic is actually recycled. According to the most recent data estimates available from the Environmental Protection Agency, just 8.7% of the plastic that was discarded in the U.S. in 2018 was recycled. The popular perception that plastic is easily and widely recycled has been shaped by decades of carefully calculated messaging, designed and paid for by the petroleum and gas companies that make most of the plastic in the first place, and the beverage companies that depend on plastic to bottle their products. Recycling is sold as a means of not worrying about the problem, says Judith Enck, a former regional administrator at the EPA, now a visiting professor at Bennington College in Vermont, and president of Beyond Plastics, a group focused on ending plastic pollution. The company is paying for the ads that frame recycling as an easy solution to a potentially devastating environmental problem. Know that recycling cannot keep up with the flood of new plastic, Inc. says. One of the four things happens to plastic after you're done with it. If it's not recycled, and usually not, it is landfilled, incinerated, or littered. The EPA estimates that in 2018, about 16% of U.S. plastic waste was incinerated. A relatively small amount was littered. Most of the rest ended up in landfills, including a lot of plastic people dutifully put into recycling bins. Over decades, or even centuries, much of that littered and landfill plastic breaks down into tiny particles known as microplastics, which contaminate our food, the air, and water. They also accumulate in our bodies, potentially increasing our risk of chronic inflammation and other ills. Experts say that while cutting back on plastic use is a worthy individual goal, the only way to stem the rising tide of plastic is for companies to make less of it and for recycling programs to be retooled so that more of what we throw away is actually turned into something useful. There's little to suggest this will happen anytime soon. Plastic production is expected to more than double by 2050, and if it doesn't, then even if it doesn't, the plastic trash that people continue to throw away will still have to go somewhere. The truth about plastic recycling. Dedicated bins for plastic waste are a common sight, and plastic recycling is widely promoted. So why does only a fraction of the plastic we toss actually get recycled? One reason is that most plastic isn't easily recyclable, says Jan Dale, a chemical engineer who heads up the Last Beach Cleanup, a nonprofit focused on plastic pollution. Plastic products are often made with mixtures of many chemicals, which can stymie recycling processes by making it harder to isolate a base material that could be recovered and reused. Perhaps the most important reason is there are very little financial incentive to recycle. It's far less expensive to manufacture most types of plastic from scratch than it is to recycle old plastic into something new. The least recyclable plastic products include many labels with the number 3 through 7 in the recycling triangle, as well as the majority of plastic bags and packaging film. Certain types of plastic, however, are economically viable and relatively easy to recycle, and even in high demand. These include PET plastic bottles like the ones soda and water are sold in, and HDPE milk jugs, respectively labeled with the number 1 or 2 inside the recycling triangle. But just 29% of the plastic used in these jugs and bottles was recycled in 2018. According to guidelines from the Federal Trade Commission, at least 60% of Americans should have access to a program that recycles a particular item before it can be labeled as recyclable without some language noting access to recycling may be limited. But those guidelines are rarely followed, according to a 2020 report from Greenpeace. How to quit plastic. Ways to reduce this kind of waste and its environmental impact right now. Like going on a diet, the first step in reducing the amount of single-use plastic we discard is to understand how much we really consume. Judith Enck, president of Beyond Plastics, a nationwide anti-plastic campaign, suggests looking at the plastic we throw away on a daily basis for an honest assessment of our consumption and for clues on how we can make most impact. I saw that I used a lot of Keurig pods, so I switched to using a French press, says Eric Sess. My husband is a big orange juice drinker, and now we use frozen concentrated juice to avoid plastic jugs and cartons. You don't need to become an eco-warrior overnight. Take it one product at a time and work your way up, says Deb Singer, the leader of the plastic bag band at Whole Foods and co-founder of Bring It, reusable shopping bags. Starting with one thing makes it more palatable to make other changes. In addition to personal actions, you can push for producer responsibility laws that slow the flow of plastic at its source. With plastic pollution, the tap is overrunning, says Mariana Valaprieto Cervantes, Walker Equity and Ocean Program Manager for Green Latinos. We have to turn off the tap before we can clean up this mess. Bags. 5 trillion plastic bags are used worldwide every year. They can last more than 500 years. Do first. Bring your own reusable bags and refuse plastic ones. Brigit makes eco-friendly compostable cellulose bags, but just about any reusable bag is better than a single-use plastic bag. Each reusable bag could cancel out hundreds to thousands of plastic bags. Use mesh cloth bags for your produce, and try to avoid fruits and vegetables packed in plastic wrap or clamshells. Do more. Kick your zipper food storage ban habit. Use reusable silicone or paper-based bags instead. Avoid plastic poop bags for your dog's waste. Use paper-based alternatives or a pooper scooper if you have a yard. Stop using trash bags. If you compost food-based, use a garbage disposal and recycle aluminum and glass products. What's left should be innocuous enough to go straight to the trash bin. Food containers, 37%. The U.S. accounted for 37% of the world's food service disposables in 2010. Do first. Bring your own empty containers to restaurants for leftovers. Cut back on takeout. Dine at restaurants and cook more at home more often. Now, this doesn't apply during the COVID crisis. If ordering delivery requests that condiment packets, cutlery, and straws be excluded. Avoid foods wrapped in plastic. At a supermarket deli, ask your order to be wrapped in paper or bring your own container. If you do buy something in a plastic container, get only the packaging mark 1 or 2 on the bottom, Inc. says. Those can actually be recycled. Do more. Avoid prepackaged foods. Bring empty containers from home and fill up with pasta, grains, and nuts. If what you need isn't available in bulk, opt for a brand that uses paper, glass, or metal packaging. Beverage, 1.84% Starbucks beverages served in a reusable cup in 2013. And 21 to 34 billion plastic beverage bottles end up in the ocean each year. Do first. Don't buy drinks in plastic bottles. Pick something that comes in aluminum, which can definitely be recycled. It's pretty easy to switch from buying your soda in plastic bottles to buying it in cans. Bring a reusable coffee cup, travel mug, or glass jar to the coffee shop. Know how many ounces it holds so that you can be charged accordingly. If you forget your cup, ask for your order to be made for here in a mug, says Danny Tucker, founder of Vessel, a reusable coffee cup return system, operated in Berkeley, California, and Boston, Colorado. If you must use a throwaway cup, at least decline the lid. Do more. Carry a reusable water bottle and refill it with tap water. Using a reusable water bottle instead of buying and recycling water bottles can reduce your global warming impact by as much as 98%. Use your own glass, metal, or silicone straw, or use just your lips to sip. Make your own sparkling water with a soda maker. It'll also save you money in the long run. Avoid plastic tea bags. Those fancy pyramid-shaped tea bags release microplastics into your brew and can wind up in landfills. Choose loose or paper bags instead. Wraps and filled. 196 million is the number of Americans who reported using at least one roll of plastic wrap in the last 6 months of 2020. Do first. Stop using plastic wrap. Use stretchy silicone covers, beeswax wraps, or aluminum foil to wrap foods. Or simply put the food in a bowl and cover it with a plate. Stop local instead of ordering online. If I'm ordering something online, I add a note requesting they not use plastic packaging. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, says Deval Prieto Cervantes. Do more. Shop the frozen food aisle sparingly. Just about everything you find there is wrapped in plastic, even if the exterior package is cardboard. Buy in bulk or bake it yourself. Purchasing fewer snack packs as individually wrapped foods, such as chips, cookies, and granola bars, will help reduce plastic waste. Cleaning and personal care. 158,100,000 Americans used disposable razors in 2020. Stop buying products packaged in plastic. Buy soap, shampoo, detergents, and cleaning products packaged in paper, glass, or aluminum. Ditch plastic razors. Use a metal razor with replaceable blades instead. Opt for natural sponges instead of synthetic sponges. Avoid exfoliating scrubs and toothpastes with microbeads, which are tiny plastic balls. Do more. Stop using sanitizing and flushable wipes. These are often made of plastic fibers that clog sewers and don't degrade in landfills. Consider using cloth diapers. To reduce environmental impact, get them secondhand, wash them with full loads, and air dry if possible. Avoid plastic tampons and pads. Use all cotton pads and tampons with cardboard applicators and paper wrapping, or a menstrual cup or period underwear. Only numbers 1 and 2 bottles and jugs are recycled consistently. Labeling other items as checked locally inside a recycling triangle is just greenwashing, a way for a company to imply that something will be recycled when it will almost certainly end up at a landfill. Well-intentioned consumers are also partially responsible for the low plastic recycling rate. Wishcycling, or tossing every type of plastic into the recycling bin and hoping for the best, can make separating out useful material more difficult and actually reduce the amount of plastic that is recycled, says Jeff Donlevy, the general manager at a California recycling facility who has been in the industry for more than 25 years. This can lead to recyclable plastic ending up in landfills and incinerators. In theory, sorting plastic and depositing only readily recyclable types into a recycling bin would help fix this problem. According to a May 2021 nationally represented survey of 2,079 U.S. adults by CR, 65% of Americans say typically separate plastic for recycling. But U.S. recycling trends have worked against this type of sorting. Many municipalities have switched to single-stream recycling, in which aluminum cans, glass bottles, plastic jugs, and paper and cardboard all get dumped into the same bin. That can make things easier for the consumer, but it also makes sorting out recyclable plastic more difficult, so more ultimately ends up discarded rather than recycled. On the bright side, most discarded plastic bottles are collected and recycled in states that require people to pay a bottle deposit, but only 10 states currently have such laws. Burning questions. Until 2018, the U.S. shipped as much as half its plastic recycling abroad, mostly to China and Hong Kong, where it was not always recycled either. Tired of dealing with contaminated plastic bales that were largely waste, China in 2018 stopped taking all but the most pristinely sorted plastic. Other countries quickly followed suit. With fewer offshore disposal options, more and more plastic is piling up in the U.S., where it is landfilled or routed to municipal solid waste incinerators that burn non-recyclable plastics along with other trash to generate electricity. Because it generates power, incineration can sometimes be framed as a form of renewable energy or reuse. The EPA describes it as combustion with energy recovery, but it is not clean energy. Incineration of plastic in these facilities had led to a slight increase in greenhouse gas emissions in recent years, according to EPA data. Burning out plastic also creates dioxides and furans, two types of toxic chemicals that can spread through the air and contaminate food, water, and soil. Over time, inhaling these chemicals can increase cancer risk, according to Marilyn Howarth, M.D., an occupational environmental medicine physician at the University of Pennsylvania. What's more, incinerators are often situated in poorer communities and already have a high burden of air pollution from such sources as heavy industry and transportation. Residents of these areas face health concerns, including cardiovascular disease, childhood asthma, exposure to carcinogenic pollutants, preterm births, according to a 2019 report published by the New School's Tishman Environmental Design Center, with support from the Global Alliance for Interior Incinerator Alternatives. About 4.4 million people in the U.S. live within a 3-mile radius of an incinerator, according to that report. The plastics industry has proposed alternatives to incinerators and landfills. One breaks down plastic into a type of fuel. Another uses a chemical process to separate plastic into its component chemicals, which could then be used to make new plastic products. But these alternatives are not likely to solve the plastic problem anytime soon. One assessment of advanced plastic to fuel recycling processes commissioned by a plastic bag company found that in some cases it could emit more greenhouse gases than the landfilling or incinerator process. In a statement, the American Chemistry Council, an industry group representing plastic manufacturers, said it expects such facilities, which are still relatively new, to operate more efficiently over time. Experts say that recycling with a chemical process is not economically viable because making new virgin plastic from oil and gas is still much cheaper. It fundamentally just doesn't work. A cleaner future? From an environmental perspective, the biggest benefit of increasing the plastic recycling rate is not keeping plastic out of landfills or incinerators. The value of recycling is displacing virgin production because the amount of pollution generated when producing virgin materials is much greater than generated when using recovered materials. Legislative changes and consumer pressure could certainly create more of a market for at least some of the plastic that is now going straight into incinerators and landfills. A legal requirement or company commitment to use more recycled material in plastic products, including those made of less frequently recycled plastic, could create incentives for manufacturers to make more recyclable products and for recycling facilities to do a better job sorting and processing and actually recycling that material. For example, The high demand for the Type 1 plastic used in PET beverage bottles is largely due to consumers pressuring the beverage companies to improve recycling processes and lawmakers requiring them to use a certain percentage of recycled plastic in their products. A California law passed last year, for instance, requires beverage bottles to be made of 15% recycled plastic. That will increase by 25% by 2025 and 50% by 2030. Requirements like these force manufacturers to change the makeup of their products to use more recyclable plastic or more environmental friendly materials, says Shanika Whitehurst, Associate Director of Sustainability Research and Testing at CR. Consumers can really change the push of market, says Shelley Miller, PhD, a professor at the University of Michigan School for Environment and Sustainability. Plastic companies are actively looking into better recycling methods and how to design plastic to be more easily recyclable, because they know this is such an important consumer issue. The American Chemistry Council recently said it supports a national standard that would require all plastic packaging to contain at least 30% recyclable materials by 2030. Another part of the solution, according to Eric Lefstad and others, is extended product responsibility, which will require plastic makers and sellers to be responsible in some way for the life cycle of their products, including cleanup after they are sold. EPR usually involves producers either implementing collection programs themselves or funding local collection programs to ensure more products are recycled. An EPR system in British Columbia, for example, increased the share of plastic waste collection for recycling from 42% in 2018 to 52% in 2020. In 2021, Maine became the first state in the U.S. to pass EPR legislation addressing packaging waste. The law will level fees on companies that create or use packaging. Fees will be lower for practices with less environmental impact, like recyclable materials. The fees will be used to local recycling efforts. Oregon passed an EPR law soon after Maine, and six other states have EPR bills in the works. Inc. says other worthy goal is eliminate single-use plastics like plastic bags and polystyrene foam. But for a change to have a positive impact, the items that replace them have to actually be reused. And often, says the University of Michigan's Miller, someone who goes to the grocery store and forgets to bring reusable bags and every time buys a new reusable bag is creating more harmful single-use items, she says. That suggests the real consumers need to make, the real shift consumers need to make. More than just avoiding plastic, we need to evaluate our behavior and move away from unnecessary consumption and living a throwaway lifestyle. Good luck on that. If we're really honest, any solution requires to analyze our own consumption to try to understand what we're consuming and why, and whether there are ways to reduce our individual consumption, Miller says. She acknowledges that a tall order for a lot of people. It's much easier to say, I can consume anything I want. I'll just recycle it. Traveling made easier. Understaffed hotels, airline delays and cancellations, and car rental shortages may be common now, but our inside advice can help you make your trips this fall go smoothly. Simplify your trip. Take only carry-on luggage and keep your key documents where you can access them quickly. Mask up when traveling by air or other public transportation and when it's recommended at your destination. Double-check all reservations to avoid delays and keep those customer service phone numbers handy in case something goes awry on your trip. Can I do anything now to make travel easier later in the season? Make sure your driver's license, passport, and other important documents are current. If not, fill out renewal forms ASAP, but expect extra long delays. Routine passport service can now take up to 18 weeks, and expedited requests up to 12 weeks, but they just announced recently that they're speeding that up. Considering enrolling in Clear Global Entry or the Transportation Security Administration's TSA PreCheck will let you fast-track through security. Some premium credit cards may offer membership, as well as airport lounge access, where you can wait comfortably for your boarding call, have a snack, and get help with same-day scheduling changes, says Ted Rossman, Senior Industry Analyst at creditcards.com. If you need a rental car, reserve now, download the airline and other travel provider apps, and save their contact information. Do I need to take health precautions for U.S. travel? Yes, the Center for Disease Control and Prevention advises Americans to delay until 2 weeks after their final COVID-19 vaccination. If you're unvaccinated and must travel, the CDC recommends a COVID-19 test 1 to 3 days before, a mask on public transportation, including airplanes, and as otherwise required, and social distancing. Get tested 3 to 5 days after returning and self-quarantine for 7 days. Even if you're fully vaccinated, the CDC advises masking up in certain areas, and some business and community rules require it. And take your vaccine record in case any venues ask for it. How about a couple of quick road reports as we end this up? Buying used is not necessarily cheaper. The average price paid for new and one-year-old used cars reached parity in 2021, and a shortage of new cars means that deals can be hard to find. The demand for SUVs and pickups remains high, says Jake Fisher, senior director of CR's Auto Test Center. A midsize sedan might suit your needs just as well, and you're more likely to find a bargain on one. The Jeep Wrangler 4XE. The 4XE is the first-ever plug-in hybrid version of the iconic Wrangler, pairing a turbo four-cylinder with electric motors for a combined output of 375 horsepower and 22 miles of electric range. The Wrangler 4XE can traverse boulders and muddy trails powered only by electricity. But the transition between electric and gas aren't very smooth, and the Wrangler's clumsy on-road handling, elevated windows, and bare-bones cabin remain. The 4XE comes with a $100 to $10,000 premium, but buyers qualify for a $7,500 federal tax incentive. Base price is $51,000 to $56,000 for a $1,500 destination charge, and the price as they drove it was $67,000. The vital statistic, $640. Annual savings gained by switching from a car that gets 22 miles per gallon to a comparable hybrid that gets 35 miles per gallon. And there's a picture of a steering wheel with two lines on it. What does this icon mean? The relatively new symbol is becoming the norm for continuous lane-keeping assistance. Unlike momentary lane-keeping assistance, which activates only when a vehicle is departing a lane, this feature works to keep the vehicle continuously in or near the center of the lane. These systems can't see well when vehicles ahead obscure the lines or the road curves out of sight, says Kelly. Funkhauser, CR's program manager for vehicle interface testing, so drivers must remain vigilant at all times, even while using these. How about a couple of all-in-a-day's work? My 14-year-old's first job was as a dishwater at a restaurant. After his first shift, he came home upset, saying his co-workers had laughed at him. Why would they do that, I asked. Because our boss posted my application on the bulletin board in the kitchen, where it asked how I learned about the job. I wrote, my mother taught me. First job woes, had a job walking 5 chihuahuas. When they got tired, I had to carry them home. 2 in my arms, 2 on my shoulders, and 1 on my head. I earned $30 working construction for a temp agency. When I finished, there was a $35 parking ticket on my car. A woman yelled at me for watching her swim. I was a lifeguard. And with that, we've just about run out of time for today's episode of Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. Be sure to listen in next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, nzreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. I'm Jim Cronin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. So long until next week, and thanks so much for listening.